Helen Caldicott on Nuclear Fallout and the book by Fred Pearce.
The book Fallout by Fred Pearce is a fascinating insight into a few of the disastrous episodes which took place during the hasty and ill-informed projects of the nuclear age. To his credit, Pearce travelled to and recorded details of some of the most radioactive polluted landscapes in the world.
After hearing the podcast from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation with Dr. Helen Caldicott, anti-nuclear campaigner since the late 1970s, I turned to the book she was praising. The editors at Beacon Press in Boston, where Fallout was published in 2018, sum up the trajectory of the book, quote, "From Hiroshima to Chernobyl, from Fukushima to the growing legacy of lethal radioactive waste, humanity's struggle to conquer atomic energy is rife with secrecy, deceit, human error, blatant disregard for life, short-sighted politics, and fear. Fallout is an eye-opening odyssey through the first 8 decades of this struggle and the radioactive landscapes it has left behind. We are, Fred Pearce finds, forever torn between technological hubris and all too human terror about what we have created. At first, Pearce reminds us, America loved the bomb. Las Vegas, only 70 miles from the site of some 100 atmospheric tests, crowned 4 misatomic bombs in the 1950s. Later, communities downwind of these tests suffered high cancer rates. The fate of a group of Japanese fishermen who suffered high radiation doses from the first hydrogen bomb test in Bikini was worse. The U.S. Atomic Energy Commission accused the fishermen of being communist spies and ignored requests from the doctors desperately trying to treat them. Pearce moves on to explore the closed cities of the Soviet Union where plutonium was refined and nuclear bombs were tested throughout the 1950s and 60s, and where the full extent of environmental and human damage is only now coming to light. Exploring the radioactive badlands created by nuclear accidents, not only the well-known examples of Chernobyl and Fukushima, but also the little-known area around Sachikovo in Russia's Ural Mountains and the Windscale fire in the UK. Pearce describes the compulsive secrecy, deviousness, and lack of accountability that have persisted even as the technology has morphed from military to civilian use. Finally, Pearce turns to the toxic legacies of nuclear technology, the emerging dilemmas over handling its waste and decommissioning the great radioactive structures of the nuclear age, as well as the fearful doublethink over the world's growing stockpiles of plutonium, the most lethal and ubiquitous product of nuclear technologies. End quote from the editors at Beacon Press about the book Fallout. In April 2019, the anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott was asked by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation to comment on this book, Fallout, by Fred Pearce. He is the host of the podcast, Robin Williams.
The word nuclear still causes trepidation in the community and in politics. In the last few days, the Prime Minister has ruled out nuclear power as an option as Australia confronts its tricky energy choices. As for those nuclear weapons, the many thousands that still stand by, as they have for decades, that danger slips the mind as the years go by. Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin have the say about their ultimate use. It is a situation that has troubled Dr. Helen Caldicott all her adult life, since she read Neville Shute's famous novel On the Beach about a possible nuclear holocaust. She was still studying in Adelaide. After graduating as a paediatrician and teaching at Harvard, Dr. Caldicott specialised in treating cystic fibrosis, but then also campaigned across the USA against what she saw as a nuclear threat. She became very famous as a result. Here she reflects on that early history of testing via a book written by environmental journalist Fred Pearce.
The book Fallout by Fred Pearce is a fascinating insight into a few of the disastrous episodes which took place during the hasty and ill-informed projects of the nuclear age. To his credit, Pearce travelled to and recorded details of some of the most radioactive polluted landscapes in the world. The Russian saga. In Semipalatinsk in Kazakhstan, the Soviet Union conducted 619 nuclear explosions, 122 of which were atmospheric. The most dangerous was in 1949 when a bomb exploded just 120 feet above the Earth, thereby lofting huge amounts of radioactive soil into the atmosphere. People downwind were bombarded with fallout, many developing acute radiation sickness with vomiting, diarrhea and fatal bleeding. Hundreds of thousands continued to be affected as they ate food on radioactively contaminated land, while increased incidences of leukemia, deformed fetuses and other diseases have been reported. However, very few scientific epidemiological studies have ever been conducted on this damaged population. The next site was Plutonium Mountain, or Degelin Mountain, within the Soviet testing zone, where 181 tunnels were dug between 1961 and 89 in order to test the effects of conventional explosives on plutonium. Plutonium is a fuel for nuclear weapons. 2.5 kilos is critical mass. It is also one of the most dangerous toxins, and its radioactive life is a quarter of a million years. The Russians, with gay abandon, exploded or distributed hundreds of kilos composed of chunks or particles of plutonium within these tunnels. In 91, after the Soviet collapse, the locals were digging up contaminated machines and metal scraps, not knowing the acute toxicity of plutonium. Siegfried Hecker, former director of Los Alamos National Weapons Labs, estimated there were 200 kilos of plutonium in these tunnels, enough to make many primitive atomic bombs, and hugely carcinogenic to exposed individuals. Incidentally, the British conducted similar plutonium experiments in Maralinga, South Australia, releasing 22.6 kilos over the desert sands, including jets of molten plutonium. A superficial clean-up buried some of the contaminated soil in pits. Back to Russia. In 1946, 1,000 miles from Semipalatinsk in Mayak, a plutonium production plant was hastily conducted to build the Soviet bombs. It experienced 7 criticality accidents, and slipshod work contaminated hundreds of workers and large areas of countryside. Hundreds of workers developed lung, liver and bone cancer and leukemia, while female workers suffered the most. In 1957, a massive explosion in one of the waste tanks spread radiation over hundreds of miles. 20 villages were evacuated, and the evacuees were never told why. But the Mayak plant also poured one Olympic swimming pool of lethal radioactive wastes every 2 hours into the adjacent Tika River, seriously contaminating hundreds of miles of marshes, fish and food, thereby exposing thousands of people to huge doses of radiation from strontium-90, cesium-137 and other isotopes. But that's not all. The most radioactive waste from Mayak were discharged into a small lake, Karache, near the plant. This lake subsequently dried up, and in 1957, strong winds catastrophically spread 1 million curies of extremely radioactive dust over the land. Now to America. Its haste to construct a total of 70,000 to 77,000 nuclear weapons, a shoddily built plant was constructed at Rocky Flats, Colorado, where mostly women machined plutonium pits in leaky glove boxes from plutonium made in reactors at Hanford, Washington. Plutonium is spontaneously flammable, and in 1957 a plutonium fire and explosion erupted, burning over 20.5 kilos of deadly plutonium, and to this day it's unknown how much escaped to the air. It contaminated surrounding areas, populations, and possibly Denver, thus emulating the Bayak fire. On Mother's Day in 1969, a similar fire recurred. Plutonium waste was also sprayed over adjacent land. Employees incinerated it at night. Plutonium was dumped in landfills, and 5,000 highly dangerous liquid waste drums were stacked outside on pad 903. The incidence of cancer in adjacent suburbs substantially increased over time, although official epidemiological studies have not been conducted. Some people now want to convert this large, now empty, highly contaminated area into a wildlife refuge open to the public. Again in 57, another dreadful fire occurred in the plutonium-producing Windscale nuclear reactor in Britain, which showered the Irish Sea and the Lake District with cesium-137, strontium-89 and 90, and polonium-210, even more deadly than plutonium. The Irish Sea is the most radioactive sea in the world. So three major accidents took place in 57 in Russia, America and Britain, all side effects in their mutual haste to become nuclear nations. Little data has been collected to estimate the number of fatalities, malignancies and associated diseases that would have occurred in these doomed guinea pig populations. As Pierce said, these tragedies were caused by an unseemly rush to manufacture as many bombs as possible at almost any cost, human and otherwise. But accidents called broken arrows happened with the actual bombs themselves. Pierce only describes two, but there were more, including one in Goldsboro, North Carolina in 1961, when a B-52 crash containing two 3 to 4 megaton bombs, each 250 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb. And in one bomb, 5 of the 6 safety catches failed to work. In 1956, a B-52 plane armed with 4 hydrogen bombs crashed in Spain and 2 of the conventional explosives detonated, contaminating large areas with deadly plutonium. In another accident in 1968, a B-52 crashed in Greenland, spreading plutonium over ice and ocean. Luckily, none of these massive hydrogen bombs exploded, but the cleanup lasted years. Pierce goes on to describe 150 Minutemen missile solos in the US Midwest, each missile armed with a hydrogen bomb of 300 kilotons, 24 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb. A similar situation pertains in Russia. However, these situations are just the tip of the nuclear Armageddon iceberg. We sit on a razor's edge as enmity builds apace between Russia and America, each with over 1,000 hydrogen bombs on hair trigger alert, ready to be launched with a 3-minute lead time, while Trump is accompanied 24 hours with a nuclear button. Our lives and life on Earth is in extreme peril when it only takes 1,000 bombs landing on 100 cities to create nuclear winter, and those who have not already perished will freeze to death in the dark.
Thoughts on the industrialisation of war as we reflect on the Anzac Day weekend. And as Dr. Caldicott mentioned, we too had nuclear tests at Maralinga, as well as in the Pacific, with the French exploding bombs as late as the mid-1990s. Dr. Caldicott is a paediatrician who campaigned across the USA against such weapons. She now lives on the south coast of New South Wales. Fred Pierce's book is called Fallout. I'm Robin Williams.
Thanks to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and Dr. Helen Caldicott for permission to rebroadcast this podcast, recorded on April 28, 2019. The last set of chapters in the book Fallout deal with cleanup, a task that needs to be addressed everywhere right now. In describing the scale, Fred Pierce wrote, "The atomic age has created a fast-growing legacy of abandoned reactors and radioactive waste. That legacy is rapidly turning into a nightmare, a $1 trillion liability comprising radioactive concrete and steel, fuel rods, sludges, and hot liquids. Some of it will be dangerous for tens of thousands of years. Much of it is languishing in dilapidated stores, leaking tanks, or flooded salt mines, from which it may have to be retrieved. Most of it has nowhere safe to go. Germany is finding that going nuclear-free does not free it from the waste burden. On British coasts, the carcasses of nuclear reactors are likely to sit abandoned into the 22nd century. And my home country also houses perhaps the most alarming legacy of all, more than 130 tons of terrorist-ready plutonium in a poorly protected store on the Cumbrian coast. End quote. Then Fred Pearce tells the story of the decommissioning of a British nuclear power plant. Sizewell, the nuclear laundryman. On the last day of December 2006, the Sizewell A plant on the coast of Suffolk in eastern England stopped generating electricity after 40 years on the grid. Cameras in the control room broadcast the switch off to the local sports club, where there were rounds of applause and toasts from men who had worked there since the early days. The plant seemed to have got to the end in good order. Its original design life of 20 years had been doubled. Now it was set for decommissioning. Then the plant would be put into what its engineers call care and maintenance before eventual dismantling to leave a greenfield site. What could possibly go wrong? In the following days, the two reactors were depressurized and a lot of equipment was taken offline. The final batch of 5,000 spent fuel rods was put into skips and lowered onto the bottom of a giant pond next to the reactors, while the rods slowly cooled. Then something went wrong. At 10:45 on the morning of Sunday, January 7, exactly a week after shutdown, a plastic pipe circulating water to the cooling pond split. Water burst through a 16-foot gash. With water continuing to leave, but no more arriving, the pond rapidly began to empty. Nobody noticed. Within 45 minutes, the water level had dropped by more than a foot. The tops of the hot fuel rods were on the verge of being exposed to the air. If that had happened, they would have swiftly overheated and set in chain a major nuclear disaster with radioactive cesium-137 and iodine-131 released into the air over Suffolk. Luckily, at that moment, an operator went into a laundry room next to the pool to sort some clothes. He noticed the floor was flooded and alerted the control room. They stopped the circulation pumps, halting the leak. It was a lucky escape. Had it not been for someone deciding to do his Sunday morning laundry minutes after the pipe ruptured, the leak might not have been spotted until the next routine 12-hourly visual inspection. The pond could drain in 10 hours. In this worst-case scenario, if the exposed irradiated fuel caught fire, it would result in an airborne off-site release, government inspectors wrote later, there was a significant risk that operators and even members of the public could have been harmed. End quote from the government. This chain of events should not have been possible. The inspectors found that the plastic pipe did not meet design specifications and had split previously, just 8 months before. Worse, a recently installed system designed to spot falling water levels in the pond had not worked. Even if it had, nobody in the control room would have noticed, because the alarm it would have triggered had already been sounding for 2 days amid what seems to have been a chaotic shutdown of equipment across the plant. The picture that emerged from the inspector's report looked like a serious failure of basic safety systems. Not a random mishap, but more systematic. You might think that the public, especially Sizewell's neighbors, should have been informed and someone held to account. Maybe there were lessons for other reactors of the same design still operating, but no. There was no prosecution, no disciplinary hearings. And the report of the government's Nuclear Installations Inspectorate, NII, was never published. Its findings only came to light 2 years later, after a Freedom of Information request from former Sellafield scientist turned nuclear consultant John Large. He was working for local anti-nuclear activists who had got wind of the accident. He published extracts. That was an excerpt from The Nuclear Laundryman about the decommissioning of the nuclear power plant Sizewell A in Britain, reported by Fred Pierce. Fred Pierce then reports on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State. Hanford, decommissioning an industry. May 9, 2017 was just another day in the life of the defunct Hanford Nuclear Reservation, a remote part of the state of Washington, covering some 600 square miles of sagebrush desert. Then alarms sounded. Almost 2,000 site workers were told to take cover indoors, and aircraft were banned from flying over the reservation for several hours. The roof of a tunnel had collapsed, exposing rail cars that had been loaded with radioactive waste from plutonium production and shunted underground for burial decades before. Suddenly, Hanford was back in the news. Straddling the Columbia River, the reservation was America's primary bomb-making factory for more than four decades. It was where they made the plutonium. At peak production during the 1960s, its nine reactors went through 7,000 tons of uranium fuel annually. Its five reprocessing plants turned that spent fuel into more than 4 tons of plutonium a year, enough to make 650 Nagasaki-sized bombs. They eventually delivered 67 tons of the metal for the American arsenal before business halted with the end of the Cold War in 1989. It was a huge task, requiring much of the electricity produced at the giant Grand Coulee Dam upstream on the Columbia, the largest power producer in America. And now the legacy of contamination is equally mind-boggling. Since production ceased, Hanford has been conducting the country's largest ever environmental cleanup program. The current cost is $2.3 billion a year. By the time it is done, the bill will be more than $100 billion, probably much more. The site holds an estimated 25 million cubic feet of solid radioactive waste, enough to fill London's Royal Albert Hall 8 times over. Much of it is buried in 40 miles of trenches and tunnels, up to 20 feet deep and 15 feet wide. 2 tunnels contain railway tracks that allow entire trains of railroad cars full of radioactive waste to be shunted in and covered over. 36 cars are reportedly down there. It was one such tunnel running directly out of the main reprocessing plant, the 1,000-foot-long Purex plant, that caved in along a 20-foot stretch in 2017. Elsewhere on the reservation, there are huge stores of spent fuel. One building contains 6 cooling ponds, each the size of an Olympic swimming pool, holding 120 million curies of strontium and cesium waste. But the headline problem is the huge volumes of acidic and radioactive reprocessing waste accumulated over the years. All told, the 56 million gallons of these liquids and sludges stored in 177 tanks, up to 75 feet in diameter. The Hanford tanks have been seeping into the ground almost from the start. That fact was a state secret until the late 1980s. Much of this contamination is slowly flowing in underground streams towards the Columbia River. That's part of the chapter on the cleanup of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State, reported by Fred Pierce in his book Fallout, published in 2018 by Beacon Press in Boston. The 250-page book takes us from Hiroshima and Nagasaki to the bomb testing and construction sites across the world, to nuclear power and the resulting accidents, and finally, to the overwhelming task of cleanup that we are facing today. Fred Pierce has done international reporting on environmental science from 85 countries. He has written for The New Scientist, The Guardian newspaper, and Yale University's E360 website. Its many books include The New Wild, When the Rivers Run Dry, The Coming Population Crash, and The Land Grabbers. And thanks again to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and Dr. Helen Caldicott for their podcast. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.